From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. We're watching a number of stories today, including the second day of jury deliberations in the trial of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort. But let's start this hour with Iran, where U.S. sanctions are taking a toll on the economy and everyday citizens. The price of a spare car part at the mechanic, for instance, has tripled. It's a result of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. Under that deal, some economic sanctions were lifted with the idea to boost the middle class. But now President Trump's decision to reimpose those sanctions seems to be having the opposite effect. CNN senior international correspondent Nick Peyton Walsh joins us now on Skype from Tehran. Nick, thanks for speaking with us. We're seeing reports that some shops are empty. People are stocking up on foreign currency. What have you seen?
Well, I have to say, I've not seen myself emptying shops. I mean, there is still enough on the streets here. There are certain sectors, though, which are being hit, definitely. I mean, for example, we went to a Toyota repair shop, and it's a very common car used here. Obviously, because the last wave of restrictions that came in early last week were against automotive parts, the automotive sector. That's massively, well, that's stopped the inflow of foreign car parts. So if your Toyota needs a new carburetor or something or a spark plug, you have to hope that somewhere within Iran there is a stockpile of these kind of things. Now, there are obviously, there's been enough of a warning for people to have filled up their shelves in various repair shops, but the prices are extortionate.
And I know you met a taxi driver there who can't afford to repair his cab, but he still has to make the payments on his car, even though he's not really making an income. And that's affecting his family.
This particular taxi driver, Davud Taraji, his taxi's been sat there for a couple of weeks now, frankly, months, simply because he can't afford the inflated part replacement, the cost of those. As you said, yeah, he doesn't suddenly get forgiven the loan repayments he has to make on the car that he bought. So that's really hitting his bottom line hard. Mm. It took us to his home. It's kind of rare that you get to, you know, kind of match personal lives to these sort of more wide-scale policies. He took us to his house. And, you know, this is not the kind of person, really, that you would think the US would be after trying to punish. His 7-year-old son, Artin, speaks not particularly well, but he's seven, English, from expensive English lessons, trying to boost education. And this is a family that want to look outwards to the outside world. And his teenage daughter plays guitar. So, you know, we saw this strange world where they're obviously used to some degree of riches. They had a nice TV in their room. They had a double door, huge refrigerator that was obviously pretty new. But that refrigerator itself is beginning to thin out in terms of what's inside, because one impact these sanctions have had as well, they've been looming for a while before they even kicked in. That's caused, obviously, a crash in confidence in the Iranian economy, outside investment to leave, foreign firms, European firms to have to choose between the American market that's billions of dollars and the Iranian market that's a lot smaller. And so that's contributed, along with, I think it's fair to say, Iranian officials even accept some degree of economic mismanagement. That's contributed to a slide in the value of the local currency, which has impacted food prices, which really means this family of four would have been, you know, 2 years ago doing really very well, thank you. Now the taxi they had can't be driven. The passengers they used to rely on at the airport aren't coming anymore. They're getting less money in, and they're having to spend less. They're having to spend even more money just to keep the fridge stocked up.
Let's hear a little bit of your reporting. This is a scene from the car repair shop that you visited.
Donald Trump thinks that he is pushing the Iranian people to rise up against their government. Do you think that's likely to happen because of what's happening here?
No, he says, because the hungrier the people get, the more they're going to hate him. If Trump acted properly, people might even have liked him.
Nick, you told us this story about this family that is having real-world repercussions because of these sanctions. And I wonder if anyone else is talking about this idea that President Trump's policies could, in fact, have the exact opposite effect, that, in fact, it would help make people more angry against the United States and foment more anger against this country.
Well, see, this is the quandary here. Now, if you're the Trump administration, you possibly, it's fair to say, have a slightly more binary worldview. You think Iran, bad, punish the Iranian people economically, they will rise up and overthrow their government. The theory had been under the Obama administration that what you want to do is encourage moderation. So you allow the sanctions to be alleviated, you get let the economy get better, you let outside technology and influences flood into the country, and therefore this middle class, you let them get more in touch with the outside world rather than further cut them off. And then slowly, the more conservative elements in society have less traction within that society. That was the old thinking. The new thinking is just drive, frankly, attract it into the economy, let it fall apart, and then see exactly what that does politically to pressure on the more conservative, hardline parts of the regime.
And now there is a significant chance that it's getting worse, because in November, another round of sanctions are coming, and this time they're going to hit Iran's oil industry. I'm guessing that people are even more worried about that one.
That will have an impact, certainly, on Iran's economy, because a fifth of that is dependent upon oil. That could really have a much more powerful impact on the value of the currency, on their capacity to afford basic daily foodstuffs, etc. And that's, I think, where people are getting concerned about, because that may see daily life becoming, to some degree, unrecognizable from what it is now.
CNN senior international correspondent Nick Peyton Walsh in Tehran. Nick, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Members of the Catholic faith are again coming to terms with sexual abuse in the church after a scathing grand jury report was released this week. It found that hundreds of priests have abused more than 1,000 boys and girls in Pennsylvania. Many people have turned to social media to share their thoughts about the findings. Joining us now for that and how other stories of the week are starting conversations online is Femi Okey, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Lisa.
So we've heard some of the stories of the abuse in the Catholic Church. The actions are depraved. The scale is astounding. More than 300 priests have been accused of abuse in Pennsylvania alone. Obviously, Catholics are outraged by this. What are the conversations like, though, on social media?
The conversation has gone further than the Catholic Church, and there are two conversations that I'm looking at, and the way to find them if you're on social is to look for Catholic Me Too and also Church Too, and they have a hashtag in front of them. Let me give you an example. Here's Jennifer Storm says, as the stained glass shatters in your respective houses of God, do not pray for those who have been preyed upon. They do not need your prayers. They need your action, your voice, your belief, and your singular ability to create change in your community. Hashtag Catholic Me Too. I'm not going to go into details of some of these stories, Lisa, because they are really, really hard to read, let alone hard to actually talk about. So there will be some trigger warnings as you're going around looking at these various stories. There's one that captured the attention of a lot of people online, and that was from Cindy Lynn, who talked about being sexually abused by her church youth leader. Look for her Twitter handle, Healing in Midlife, without the E on the end of midlife. She talks about her experience in a California church, and in the current pastor then jumps onto the conversation and says, I am so sorry that this has happened to you. I want to apologise. I wasn't around then, but please know how sad and sorry I am for what happened to you. Mm. And then Cindy is saying, why are you even asking me this? And he says, because I want to make things better. Do we have the right policies in place? And so these are the conversations that are going beyond what's happening in this report about the Catholic Church and the priests and the sexual abuse there, and spreading out to the whole church community and Christian community around the world. So that's Catholic Me Too and hashtag Church Too.
And the conversation's unfolding, as you said, on Twitter. I want to talk about another issue in the news this week. This one has to do with technology. The CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, said that he is rethinking the core parts of the platform after Twitter temporarily suspended conspiracy theorist Alex Jones of InfoWars this week, amid a lot of pressure coming from the public. This follows Apple, Facebook, Spotify taking action earlier this month against Alex Jones. What changes is Jack Dorsey proposing to limit the spread of hate speech?
Well, he talks about this week looking at some of the core functions of Twitter. And so Twitter is designed for you to talk to each other, to have a conversation. So that conversation that I just spoke to you about, the pastor of the current church said, how can I help? I want to reach out to you. That is what Twitter does. It helps those global conversations happen. But maybe there should be some ways that you can monitor them. So you may remember just a few months ago, there was a Twitter purge. So bots were purged. Accounts that haven't been used were purged. Jack Dorsey is looking at perhaps you can highlight information that is incorrect that's being widely spread. Perhaps we can monitor account behavior more so we know when you are tweeting with an automated account and not a real person. There's a lot of room here for maybe Twitter to be able to look at the ethics of how people are using the platform and how easy it is to spread hate speech and also misinformation.
One more issue before we let you go. And this one requires, for the segue anyway, Femi, a little bit of music. There was a fence that held our love. Yes, it was. There was a gate that he walked out of. This is my heart. That's the key part right there, the house that Jack built from Aretha.
Jack Dorsey, the house that Jack built. That very nicely done, DJ Lisa.
Your ingenious segue idea, Femi, okay? What are you reading about Aretha online?
Oh, my goodness. 5 million searches and just on Wednesday alone. Amazing stories. There's so many gifts for you to be able to share. And then this story here from Jackie Moore on Facebook. She was once filming with the Queen of Soul in the UK. She was not wearing an appropriate outfit that would look good on TV. The director dared to ask her to change it, and she said, "Would you have asked the Queen of England to change her outfit? I don't think so." And so Aretha, the Queen of Soul, went on to wear whatever she wanted to wear because she's the Queen.
Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Always nice to talk to you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
NASA's Parker Solar Probe is on its way to the sun. It was launched this past Sunday from Cape Canaveral. The probe will study the sun's atmosphere. The data will help predict what are called space weather events that can damage things like satellites and disrupt communications and power grids here on Earth. If all goes as planned, it'll get 7 times closer to the sun than any mission before it. One of the challenges is to keep the sun from incinerating your satellite. And one of the key people on the team that had to come up with a sun-proof composite is a material science ceramic engineer, Dennis Nagel. He is also principal research engineer at Johns Hopkins University. He says the starting point on his team's research was to look at how the front edges of the space shuttles have withstood intense heat, in part by reflecting the energy of the sun. The key, Nagel says, is to use the properties of the color white and something in the heat shield that is unfamiliar to most of us civilians.
The carbon-carbon composite, the thermal protection shield, is made up of a sandwich structure with two carbon-carbon composite layers sandwiching in between is a carbon foam, and that handles a tremendous amount of heat. But even with the carbon composite, which is the hottest composite you can have, it can't absorb all the sun's heat. So the goal was to put something on the front that would reflect back a lot of the sun's energy. And so the idea was to put a white coating on that surface to reflect most of the heat. Without the white coating, you got temperatures of 2,500 degrees centigrade. With the coating, if you don't have the white coating, it can go well over 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
And what's the coating made of?
It's a ceramic, white ceramics, primarily aluminum oxide. It's a ceramic that's used in many applications, things like spark plugs. And when we put the white coating down, the temperature drops. It is only 1,400 to 1,500 degrees centigrade, so it can take the temperature. And it reflects a major portion of the energy that the sun is impinging on the surface.
Just like we always hear about wearing white clothes in the summer and not black clothes.
So when they talk about sunshield, for example, zinc oxide is what people often use to reflect the heat sun off a person's face when they put down the white zinc oxide.
Right. So for the probe itself, what does this carbon-carbon composite look like? I mean, how does it look on the probe?
Well, the thermal protection shield is about 9 feet in diameter, and it's for the carbon-carbon. Again, it's a structure that's composed of two layers of carbon-carbon, and in between they put a carbon foam. It looks like a regular foam you have in your kitchen, a very fine pore structure that has a very, very low thermal conductivity, so they can trap the temperature from the front surface back to where the scientific instruments are. The instruments have to be at room temperature to make their measurements of the atmosphere around the sun.
And what would the temperature be like on the exterior, and what would it be like on the interior?
Well, the exteriors that they've calculated and shown is going to be right around 2,500 degrees F. And on the interior, all the experiments that they're going to have done and the spectrometers and the equipment is going to be at room temperature.
Room temperature. And that's where all the important stuff is there.
That's right. All the experiments they're going to do to test the solar corona will be run at room temperature. I'm as confident as APL and NASA are that once we've got it in space, and now I think we've done all the tests we can do and imagine of all the situations it's going to see, that the coating will survive.
How long is this probe going to be up there?
It's going to be a 7-year mission, I believe. every time it goes in proximity to the sun, it has to survive about 8 hours, I believe. And every time it comes around the sun, it gets closer. So in 2025, it's going to be the closest. That's when it's going to be 4 million miles away. So each time it goes around, they'll collect data.
You nervous?
Me?
Yeah.
About that? No.
No. Good. It's a good sign.
For me, it's an interesting one because by the time they get through the 7 years, you know, I'll be 81.
Oh.
So it's a nice end of career project.
But young enough to enjoy it.
That's right.
Dennis Nagel, thank you so much. Really nice to speak with you.
Right, thank you.
You could call it pee cycling. Researchers in Vermont are experimenting with turning human urine into fertilizer for farms and gardens. With a grant from the National Science Foundation, the Rich Earth Institute is testing the effectiveness of fertilizing with urine sanitized with heat and figuring out whether trace amounts of medications would make their way into food. The concept is not new. Bags of fertilizer made from processed human waste solids are showing up in more and more nurseries around the country. According to the EPA, it's perfectly safe to use in any garden. But as Jacob Fenston from member station WAMU reports, an environmental group is questioning just how safe it is.
Every day, the 700,000 residents of the District of Columbia, plus a lot of visitors, do this. Each flush travels through a network of almost 2,000 miles of sewer pipes to the city's southernmost tip.
So yeah, this is what I think of when I think of a wastewater treatment plant. It's a big circular tank and sort of a foul smell.
So this is one of our sedimentation basins. If you're ever flying into Reagan, you can look down, you can spot us pretty easily.
Bill Brower works for DC Water. He tells me this is the first step in treating sewage, separating out what's politely referred to as solids.
When we think about it, that's organic matter, it's nitrogen, it's phosphorus, it's essentially plant food.
4 years ago, Washington, D.C. became the first city in North America to install this high-tech system to turn human waste into a rich soil amendment. Giant pressure cookers kill pathogens, then microbes digest the solids even further in what's basically a huge composter. The final product is called Bloom, and the smell is not bad.
The most common descriptor we get of the odors for our material is kind of an earthy smell, maybe a bit musty.
DC Water spent almost $500 million on this system, but Brower says the utility will recoup the cost within 15 years, both by producing electricity from methane during the process and by selling Bloom to gardeners and landscapers. Currently, DC Water sells only about 1/8 of what it produces and gives away the rest. Now, marketing is being ramped up, and for the first time, Bloom is being sold in big blue and white bags at nurseries in the DC area.
This is my country Cadillac.
Francis Gowen is a plant physiologist, retired from the University of Maryland. In his electric golf cart, he's showing me around his large, lush garden.
You get cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower.
All grown using Bloom. Gowen says it's one of the best fertilizers he's ever used, and he's been studying compost for decades. He's worked on projects composting all sorts of things. Crab waste.
Dead chickens. Garbage.
It earned him a nickname.
The guru of composting.
In the 1970s, he started working on composting human waste. His work with excrement earned him a new nickname.
King.
He says the environmental benefit is huge. It's a lot like the local food movement.
We are also now producing our local fertilizer for growing those crops. And we are replenishing in this soil those nutrients that we've taken, that we've eaten.
Sewer authorities have been recycling sewage solids for many decades. Milwaukee, Wisconsin has been doing it for more than 90 years, making a fertilizer called milorganite. The practice has been growing since the late 80s when Congress banned dumping sewage in the ocean. Despite the obvious benefits, many environmentalists are extremely skeptical. Kathy Plume is with the D.C. chapter of the Sierra Club.
Wastewater has a lot of contaminants. Over 90,000 different contaminants can be in our wastewater.
The National Sierra Club officially opposes use of any sewage sludge as a soil amendment. Even the highly treated stuff DC Water produces, she says, raises questions.
Is it okay to be using this on food-producing soils? Should it be applied to non-food-producing soils, such as along highways? Or should it not be used at all?
Across the country, more than 5.6 million tons of sewage solids are produced each year. More than half of that is put to use on land, but only a small portion is, like Bloom, deemed safe enough to use on home vegetable gardens. Bloom says more research needs to be done on the cumulative effects of using biosolids. Back at DC Water, we climb high up in a warehouse and watch finished bloom roll off conveyor belts into two enormous storage bunkers.
It's about 20 tractor trailer loads a day. People never stop contributing to the system, so we never stop producing.
Bill Brower says DC Water produces 450 tons of this stuff every single day. They've got to do something with it.
The alternate is sending this material to landfill, which seems like a terrible use. You'd fill up landfill space very quickly, and it's just a waste of a resource.
Still, the utilities agreed to a study of its bloom soil amendment. They're working with the Sierra Club on a cumulative risk assessment. Brower says he's happy to do it, but he's already convinced of its safety.
I have two small kids. I have a vegetable garden at home. I use our bloom product in my vegetable garden, and I feed it to my kids.
The technology to make this soil amendment is being adopted elsewhere. In Maryland, the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission will start producing its own fertilizer, similar to Bloom, beginning in 2024. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A lot of public companies are busy reporting their second quarter earnings to investors. We reported this week on Macy's and Uber. Yesterday, Walmart shares jumped 9% because of strong sales in the second quarter. But not everyone thinks these four annual check-ins are necessary. In fact, President Trump tweeted this morning that top business leaders want to stop quarterly reporting and move to a six-month system. Trump said in his tweet that he has asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to study the issue. Joining us now is Michael Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, it's Friday. It's good to have you on.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Nice to be here.
All right. So Trump does not say who these top business leaders are. So where did this come from? What's the argument for moving to a six-month reporting system?
Well, he did eventually later cite PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi by name. But there are plenty of other CEOs out there who would likely agree with this sentiment. For example, Elon Musk of Tesla has been in the news all week because...
yes, he has.
Yeah. Well, he wants to take his company private in part because it would remove the burden of reporting financials every quarter and then having to face Wall Street's reaction to it. So there definitely is a group of CEOs who would express approval for this idea.
But look, there's a burden for a reason. There's an issue of transparency. Millions of regular people are invested in these public companies, and there's a reason that we make them open up their books. These investors want to know if the businesses are healthy, if their money is safe. So is everybody on board with this? Or there's got to be some criticism here.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, there are plenty of CEOs and CFOs who would complain about it. But investors, in large part, tend to prefer the updates because, you know, they'd rather have more information than less, and they'd rather not have to wait for half a year to get an update on the companies they invest in. You know, the example I keep giving is imagine during the financial crisis, if banks only had to report twice a year and we had to wait 6 months to get an update on the outlook. It would have been a big deal, create a lot of uncertainty. So the opposite side of the CEOs and the CFOs, I think, are many investors who really do prefer getting the quarterly updates. And remember, the SEC, their role is to protect investors, not really necessarily look out for corporate CEOs.
There's this phrase related to all this. It's called quarterly capitalism. It's this argument that some companies are so worried about showing short-term gains for their shareholders every 3 months that they're neglecting a longer-term vision, which I think is something maybe you alluded to there in the first question, in the first answer. This is something that even Hillary Clinton has talked about.
Right. So, you know, there are basically two main complaints about the notion of reporting results quarterly. One, as you said, is that focus on quarterly capitalism, the idea that companies are forced to sort of meet Wall Street's expectations every quarter, and you know they get distracted by that and don't necessarily make the best long-term business decisions. The other is simply the manpower and the costs that go into produce quarterly reports. If you recall back to the early 2000s, after the Enron and WorldCom scandals, Congress passed what's known as Sarbanes-Oxley, mm-hmm. which, among other things, it requires senior executives to basically take full responsibility for the accuracy of these reports. So these executives can't just rubber stamp them. I think that's yep. a big reason why they'd prefer not to have to be part of this.
Mike Regan, Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter.
For many people, summertime means car trips with stops along the way at local fairs or historic sites. Author Christopher Kelly's road trips take him in search of a particular kind of history. He's written about it in his book, America Invaded. It's a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil. Kelly begins America Invaded with the discovery of what's called Kennewick Man. In 1996, some college students were watching a hydroplane race on the Columbia River in Washington. One of the students pulled a human skull from the water. Turns out it was part of a skeleton that's 9,000 years old, give or take, and there was a stone spear point embedded in its hip. For Kelly, that spear wound was the most captivating thing about the gruesome discovery and the battle of some sort that it suggested. Christopher Kelly, as you point out in the book, America has invaded many countries through its history, but American soil has been the site of not just battles, but invasions of different kinds. What did you find?
Well, we found evidence of certainly of fighting in every single state in the Union. Now, when you talk about a state like Nevada, for instance, which doesn't have a coastline, which is, you know, harder to invade, so to speak, and you don't have a clear evidence of, say, an occupation of Nevada by outside forces. But nevertheless, you do have signs of fighting. I mean, for instance, you have the balloon bombs that were used in the latter stages of World War II that landed on over 15 different American states, including Nevada, for example.
And the balloon bombs, tell us about those that were launched by the Japanese.
Towards the end of World War II, 1944-45, there was a campaign of hot air balloons that were put into the jet stream, launched from Japan, traveled thousands of miles, and the idea was to try to set forest fires ablaze in the United States. And there hasn't been a lot of coverage of them because at the time there was a great deal of wartime censorship, and they didn't want people to panic, to think that a bomb might be landing in somebody's backyard. There's only one incident where there are actually fatalities attributed to that, and that was in Oregon in 1945. That was on a walk, on a hike in the woods after church, kind of a little a Sunday school group stumbled on it, and actually six people, including five kids, were killed by the ignition of an incendiary bomb.
One of the things you did on your own road trip as you were compiling information for this book was to find certain sites that memorialized or at least were the exact location of some of these events. What do you think were the most impactful places?
Well, I think another example would be from my own home state of Washington, where you have the Hanford nuclear site, which is where they developed the plutonium that was used for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki that ended World War II. But this site, ironically, received a balloon bomb in the power lines in the spring of 1945. It was the only time in history that an American atomic facility was stopped by enemy action. But of course, the enemy had no idea that this had actually occurred.
Christopher, how are you defining invasion in the book? Do you count explorers as invaders? Is violence necessarily a part of it?
I think there's a fine line between exploration and invasion. If you take, for example, Captain Cook, who arrived in Hawaii twice. At first, he was seen by the native Hawaiians as being something of a godlike figure. But then when he returned to the Big Island of Hawaii on his second voyage there, he actually was killed and actually eaten. I mean, Captain Cook got cooked, so to speak, by the Hawaiians. So from his standpoint, he saw himself, I'm sure, as an explorer. But from the Hawaiians' perspective. Some of them must have seen him as an invader as well.
And you can actually see the place, the little cove on the big island of Hawaii where he was attacked.
That's right.
Take us up to Alaska now. The history of Alaska goes all the way back to the Paleolithic people more than 3 million years ago. Russian traders in the 18th century arrived on what are now Alaskan waters in pursuit of seal and animals with fur. What did they encounter with the indigenous people there?
Russia, of course, is in our headlines these days almost continually. But it's interesting as a historian to note the impact that Russia had going back into the 18th and 19th century on this country. For instance, if you go to Sitka today in Alaska, you'll find onion domed churches in the Russian style. One of the other legacies of the Russian invasion occupation of Alaska, the indigenous people in Alaska, even to this day, the majority of them are Christian, but they're neither Roman Catholic nor Protestant. They are Orthodox, which is a direct legacy of this Russian invasion, if you will, that lasted right up until 1867 when Alaska was sold to the United States of America.
If there is one thing that we should know about California and foreign influence in California based on an event, what would you say it is?
Well, one of the things that stuck out for me was the attack in World War II by a Japanese submarine on the Elwood Refinery on the coast of California. You had this submarine that surfaced near Elwood, California, which is near Santa Barbara, and used its deck gun to start shelling the refinery. No harm was really done, and nobody was killed or injured by the attack, but it did have a tremendous impact. And the Rose Bowl, of course, everybody knows, is played in Pasadena, California. The one exception to that happened after the Pearl Harbor attack, when initially the Rose Bowl was actually canceled, and the two teams, which was Oregon State and Duke, decided that the game would be played in North Carolina, in Duke. That is the one Rose Bowl in 1942 Rose Bowl was actually played in North Carolina because of the fear of a Japanese invasion or attack that might be imminent.
And is there a place in California for any visitors that you would especially recommend dealing with this history?
I think another place that's interesting is San Pascual, the battlefield near San Diego. This was fought between the Americans and the what were called the Californios, who were defending the Mexican control over California at the time. It was the most significant battle because it really was the victory for the Americans that led to California becoming part of the United States.
Your road trip, Christopher, took you to New England as well. What is it about this part of the Northeast U.S. that you found most remarkable in terms of American states, American territories being invaded?
One of the things that's astonishing about New England is even in Civil War history, I mean, the people think of the Civil War as being fought, you know, mainly, of course, in the South and except for Gettysburg and Pennsylvania. But in fact, Vermont was actually technically invaded. I mean, the town of St. Albans in Vermont in 1864, there were Confederates that crossed the border from Canada that invaded south, in other words, in the southerly direction to go into St. Albans, which is in the extreme north of Vermont. Here we talk today about the problematic nature of international borders. I mean, you had Confederates crossing the Canadian border during the Civil War, so it was even an issue back in those days as well.
Tell us about the fight over Lake Champlain.
Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne in 1777 famously invaded New York from Canada. I mean, in a way, that's maybe the most significant invasion for American history, because, of course, this invasion was repulsed and Burgoyne was defeated and surrendered after the battles of Saratoga. And the surrender of John Burgoyne was what gave credibility to the American Revolution and led to France intervening on behalf of America during the American Revolution, which, of course, led to ultimately to victory at Yorktown and to the creation of the United States.
One other thing, Christopher, I wanted to mention, and that is that you dedicate the book to two of your own ancestors.
I dedicated the book to Jane Wells, who was an ancestor of mine who was killed during the American Revolution at the Cherry Valley Massacre in upstate New York by Native Americans that had been recruited by the British to attack the American rebels. And also another ancestor of mine whose name was Captain Cortland Van Rensselaer, who was in the Union Army and died at Nashville during the American Civil War.
It strikes me that probably a lot of people listening to this have some kind of connection to some of these skirmishes, massacres, just as you did, that they don't even know about necessarily.
many, many listeners out there will have had relatives who fought in American wars, or perhaps were victims of as well. So yes, there, I think everybody has some connection to the conflicts that I describe in the book.
Christopher Kelly, co-author of America Invaded, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
An update on that story out of New Haven, Connecticut, where the number of people who've overdosed in the past 2 days is now more than 100, many of them in broad daylight at a public park. Police say the drug responsible is something widely known as synthetic marijuana. It's also called K2 or spice. It's possible the drugs were laced with an opioid. Nobody has died, but two men were arraigned yesterday on related charges. So we'll continue to keep an eye on that story. And now this one about a common medical term: do not resuscitate. In a hospital, that means staff are not supposed to take life-saving efforts if a patient stops breathing. Doctors put that order into a patient's chart at the request of the patient. But these DNR orders can lead to unintended consequences, including withholding treatment before death. As Lisa Gillespie from WFPL in Louisville reports, the misunderstanding is common in hospitals in Kentucky and around the country.
For Kathy Roden-Gogan, her first-hand experience with do not resuscitate or DNR orders came last year, 2 days after her father was admitted to the hospital with abdominal pain.
I was asleep. We had left the hospital about 9 the night before. So a little after 5, close to 5:30, my cell phone rang.
It was a nurse who told Roden-Gogan her father's heart rate was dropping.
So I asked her, has he been moved to ICU? And she said that he had a DNR, so they couldn't move him to ICU.
13 minutes later, before she could get to the hospital, Robert Roden's heart stopped.
It was terrible to have no goodbye.
Roden had a DNR, according to public records obtained from the Kentucky Cabinet for Health and Family Services. But his medical records show he had also requested some other treatment, like drugs that work to increase heart rate and a machine that works to restore breathing. Records show he didn't get that treatment before he died. And according to experts, confusion among hospital workers about what a DNR order actually means isn't uncommon. Sarah Rosenthal is the chair of the Ethics Committee at the University of Kentucky Hospital.
DNR stands for Do Not Resuscitate, and is what we call a code status order that refers to whether we attempt to perform CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation in the event that a patient's heart stops. DNR does not mean do not treat.
DNR orders apply only when a patient's heart stops. If the patient has a DNR, they've made it known they don't want CPR to restart their heart. But studies have shown that DNR orders often wrongly affect the care patients receive before they die, too. Hospital staff either think a DNR order means they shouldn't give a patient treatment before death, or they assume a patient doesn't want treatment. Maxwell Virgo is a doctor at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. He says hospital staff misunderstanding DNR orders is a nationwide issue.
We've done surveys here that show that a DNR patient, everyone likes to extrapolate that out to before you're found dead, if you're DNR, they tend not to do other stuff because they kind of think that you're someone who wants less rather than more.
A 2014 study from Oregon Health and Science University found DNR orders were associated with a decrease in certain critical hospital treatments in California hospitals. Virgo says the problem often boils down to how a doctor interprets the patient's wishes, laid out in an electronic health record called the code status orders.
People use the code status order as like a catch-all for goals of care, you know, like, tell me all the life support you do and don't want, no matter whether your heart's beating or not. Those two patient groups are different, people who have died and people who are getting sicker.
To try to cut through the confusion, several states, including Kentucky, have adopted a new document to try to make that patient's desires clearer. The Medical Orders for Scope of Treatment, or MOST form, sets out whether a patient wants a DNR order if their heart stops. Then it moves on to describe what treatment the patient wants if they still have a pulse and are breathing. But Sarah Rosenthal says not all hospitals in Kentucky are using the form.
It's a relatively new form, and it just requires more education. basically, we need to just educate healthcare providers on the purpose of the form and the limitations of the form and how to use them.
Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center is doing something about the confusion among their staff. Maxwell Virgo says they're making it a little easier to integrate their version of the MOST form into their electronic medical record.
So I think our fix might, for right now, be a code status button that you can click and see, but that it'll have those two different categories in it, and that the providers will be trained to look at the patient and figure out which category they fit in.
That more clear-cut coding system might have helped Kathy Roding-Gogan's dad. Meanwhile, she says she's going to the state capitol to push for a more uniform way of displaying patients' DNR codes and desired treatment. And she recently did a video version of the MOST form with her own doctor, with the hope that if she's ever in the position her father was, her wishes will be more clear to hospital staff. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Gillespie.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.